Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Journalist and tech entrepreneur Mark Little, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
So Mark, we're coming up to the 100 mark day of Donald Trump's presidency, and things have taken a few alarming turns, to say the least. So we thought we should check back in with you and get some of your insights. You're just back from New York. How does it feel there now, the atmosphere?
Yeah, I'm struck by Rerun's poem about the parcel from America. You know, like many Irish people, this is not academic for us. You know, I have deep connections. My second home for many years was the United States. Many friends over 30 years that I've made, I went back to see many of them, living in New York mainly. And I was struck by two things. First of all, I knew that they had expected this. These are people who work in finance, in media, they're entrepreneurs, they're civil rights activists, they're lawyers. So I knew they'd already had a clout from what had happened. What I wasn't prepared for was how bone deep the sense of anxiety of things to come, not just what's happened. That's what struck me. So, for example, I was struck very much by a friend of mine who teaches English to migrants outside the city of New York, telling me that they're not turning up anymore. The students are just not coming to the classroom for fear of arrest. Talking to a good friend of mine who's a very sober journalist, talking about his journalism and saying, how long before a knock on the door comes from the FBI? So, you know, it's those kinds of things in people who do, they're not prone to hyperbole. These are people who live in the reality.
This is different to the last time. Remember the last time when there were crying rooms in the universities and all these people were like, oh, I feel so afraid and everything. And we were kind of like, ah, take it easy. This is completely different, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's across a breadth of people. Like an entrepreneur friend of mine said, listen, the money's just dried up now because of the tariff policies. I'm worrying about my people who've got work visas. I've got an academic friend who's not on a permanent residency. She's scared silly of what happens next for her, but her students who are international students wiping their social media history. So it's this anticipation of fear. But what was very strange for me was when I then tuned in, because I'm very aware that these people are the targets of Donald Trump. I wanted to also soak myself up in Fox News and a lot of the right-wing podcasts. And there's a fear there as well, ironically. You only have to watch the adverts on Fox News for, you know, gold coins, the only resistant investment to crisis, or water purification, and public service ads from the Trump government about immigration. That sense of fear now is mixed on the part of the MAGA people with a triumphant sense that the more the suffering of people who are my friends, the greater the achievement of this disruptor, Donald Trump. So there's a weird relationship.
Does it feel slightly as if that kind of MAGA culture that we've talked about before and that MAGA movement, are they feeling a sense of, is there a sense in the air of them being all conquering now and this is their moment, yeah?
Yeah, I think there is. I mean, the analogy I'd use is like a red hot steel pole that's put into the fire and then put into the water, and it's become harder but more brittle in the process.
Okay.
So, you know, half of the Republican Party voters last November supported the MAGA project. Now the latest polls say 71%. So there's been a consolidation of the MAGA hardcore, Trump's vision, for all those Republicans who may have been a bit ambivalent. And it's all because of popular policies for them, like deportations is a popular policy. More Americans want to deport illegal immigrants than 4 years ago. So there's this sense that he is proving to be the disruptor in ways he promised to be. But the soft edge then of that cultural movement we've talked about, the kind of people like Joe Rogan, Dave Portnoy, who's this Barstool Sports broadcaster, very famous with the MAGA cultural movement. They've been critical of Trump over policies like tariffs. Poor old Dave Portnoy lost $20 million of his net worth because of the stock market crash there. But they're kind of like sports fans, the way they see the world.
Okay.
They reserve the right to criticize the team and the manager, but they're still backing the boss. They're still backing Trump. Like Joe Rogan making critical comments about tariffs, but he was there the other night hugging him, calling him sir, saying, I'm very happy for you. So there is still a sort of
he's allowing the ecosystem to be itself a little bit and allowing a bit of manufactured dissent, if you will, but because he knows that ultimately it's all okay. The coalition is on board.
Yeah. And we've talked about this before. He has turned the Oval Office into a set for a reality TV show. It's quite ironic if you see the before and after shots of the Biden Oval Office. It's pretty dour. Yeah. You now see the Trump office, and he's put the gold in, the gold plating and the gilt. He's putting in chandeliers. He's making it a set, and he's broadcasting directly to the American people, almost like a monarch. He's got the you know, guest characters come along, like President Bukele from Salvador this week. He's got his recurrent characters, the cabinet, coming to pay him testimonials in the Oval Office, which is now the golden office for the golden age, according to the press secretary. So he's running his administration like a reality show, the first
like
king of America.
Or like a bizarro version of those late night talk shows that, you know, people don't hugely watch anymore in America. He's probably the biggest talk show in America right
and,
now.
And remember, he is the last television president. He grew up in that reality. His instincts are that. And sort of that sense of being a monarch, I think, is also a strength and a weakness. Because he's surrounded by courtiers who essentially are only giving him the good news. And it's a great irony. Today is the 250th anniversary of the first shots fired in the Revolutionary War against the monarch of Great Britain. And ultimately, we have this kind of irony of this man is running the United States, importing his favorite dictators, but ruling a little like a television reality king. And I think that is both the weakness and also a strength, given that this is a cultural movement, not a political party.
Okay, so then that kind of brings us to the question that, you know, people are starting to use the word fascist a bit more liberally. I think maybe is totalitarianism a better word for it? Does it feel like it's tipping a bit in that direction?
So I think certainly if you define authoritarianism, we can see that right now the world is in democratic recession because we're seeing examples of people who are amassing power for power's sake, like President Bukele in El Salvador, Erdogan, Turkey, Putin in Russia. And an authoritarian figure is someone who amasses power for power's sake. But there's something different when that powerful person then tries to restructure the society, root out impure elements within that society, which is basically the MAGA project. And that turns into something different. You can call it fascism because that's a pretty accurate description, but it does resonate with something in American history, I think, that we should also take into account. An American style of extremism that was there when the Know Nothing Party were persecuting Irish immigrants in the 19th century, the Ku Klux Klan after the Civil War, Father Coughlin on the radio supporting the Nazis in the 1930s, McCarthy in the 50s, the militia movements that blew up the Oklahoma Federal Building in 1995. So there's something here which is an American flavor and character to it, and its real molten core is the anger of the working class American who feels that this society and this social order is deeply unjust. And I think that molten core has to be recognized in addition to the unique style of fascism or totalitarianism.
Okay. So because, we're obviously tending to see things from a very particular perspective at the moment. But you go back to that molten core. For them, then, this is righteousness. This is their revenge on a system that served others and not them for the last decades.
Yeah, and if you listen to them talking at the moment, I've been paying a lot of attention, like to car workers in Michigan right now who know that tariffs, they actually support tariffs, right? They're giving Trump a chance because as far as he's concerned, he's delivered what they wanted, which was vengeance on the elites, disruption. And you look at working class Americans, they call themselves middle class, but working class Americans who live paycheck to paycheck. Like 6 out of 10 Americans couldn't afford an emergency that would cost them $1,000, like a car breaking down. They are living at that edge. They're the people who don't own the shares. They're the people who are not complaining about the price of avocados or burgundy wine. I mean, they're the people who are buying Kmart clothes for their kids, the shoes. They're the people dependent on Chinese-made products like air conditioners. So for them, they're in this weird position where Trump has given them what they wanted, which was to overthrow the elites or disrupt them at least. At the very same time, it's like Wile E. Coyote got off the cliff. They're in free fall right now. Gravity is about to hit as these tariffs hit their lives.
Yeah.
And this collision.
Is that awakening happening yet for them?
No, I don't think so. Not yet. Because obviously they haven't been exposed to the stock market volatility. It's about real life. And for them, it's going to be that point where they're trying to replace their car or their washing machine.
Okay.
And those places, those
they're not following the macro arguments as assiduously as we are, say, or the macro goings on. No.
I think for their point of view, they keep referring, I keep hearing this reference back to The Art of the Deal, the book that Trump wrote, because he has this character among them of being the guy that has the Versailles touch, you know, as someone said recently, he's like a little bit like Liberace meets Mussolini. He has that sort of grand character of the businessman who had it all. And I think that people are still attached to that idea. But the contradictions are enormous. Like, I have a MAGA hat that someone gave me as a present. I looked inside the other day, the label says made in China. So it is right now this collision of that sort of very visceral feeling that Trump is their champion with this approaching reality that's not kicked in just yet because the tariffs haven't hit the road. And I think when that happens, that's going to be fascinating. Now, that will result definitely in Trump probably losing the midterm elections for the Republicans. But does he care about that? I don't think so. I think he's racing to restructure American life, politics, power, economy, society within those 2 years in a way that can't be undone. I think that's the project.
Okay, so on that then, if we talk about the American century and the identity of what America has traditionally meant to us, right? So first off, the identity of America to us, right? Feels like it's changing. Even like, remember you used to be, I think one of the last times you were here, you talked about that young people didn't care too much about democracy. They wanted freedom. Trump was supposed to be all about freedom. Is it feeling over there right now like the land of the free, a place of freedom?
It's not feeling when freedom in the sense of political freedom, certainly not. And we do talk about freedom in terms of like freedom from being deported in shackles and chains. Clearly that freedom is being eroded. But for the ordinary American who says to themselves, well, it's only the worst people in this society. I'm actually thinking about my freedom from crime. I'm thinking about my freedom from dominance by the universities who set the culture and the Hollywood culture. I'm thinking about the freedom to go ahead and not think about the stock market, but about the crypto markets, which give me a chance of getting rich. There's that sense of the freedom of the frontier.
Now, so the rugged individualism myth of America.
Yeah, I think people should listen. Like, go check out the White House social media accounts to see the frontier definition of freedom. So, for example, it's a famous one now where they had a video celebrating the sensation of pleasant white noise when you hear the shackles and the chains being put on deportees as they're being sent off to El Salvador. Now, that cruelty doesn't feel like the call of a free society. But remember, it's a frontier freedom. It's not the sheriff that's going to save you. It's the vigilante among us who's going to come along and rescue decency from the barbarians in the society. So I think that sense of frontier story is so powerful in Trump's myth.
So Clint Eastwood has ridden into town. Okay, so then the American century, the idea of the you know, the American kind of empire, for want of a better word, is it threatening to end? We grew up and the world was a certain shape. Is that over?
I think there was a script you could have written, which I think in my head I'd written back after the inauguration, where you had the Make America Great nostalgia part that Trump has, and clearly policies like the illegal immigration policy, his policy of trying to make the government more efficient, responsive, would have been very popular. And then he would have hitched his wagon to the oligarchs of Silicon Valley who tell that science fiction story of an American future where America is going to do what it's always done, define the next frontier of technology, beat the Chinese. And I think if he'd pursue that policy, he'd be wildly popular right now because he would have the right mix of, you know, the old frontier mentality with this new scientific frontier. But what he's done is he's actually self-destructing American dominance in the world by essentially cutting back. And we heard in the news bulletin there that American cuts in aid, for example, are having a huge global impact. But it's the reduction in spending on scientific research that is quite stunning for me. So Trump has kind of turned his back in Silicon Valley. He wants that Make America Great part. The make is the important part of his policy.
Yeah.
He's stuck in a 1980s mentality when, you know, people like him feared Japan. And he's trying to bring manufacturing back to the United States because he knows most Americans are nostalgic for a day when they made things. But there's a great opinion poll recently that says 80% of Americans want more factories to come back to America, but only 25% of them will work in them. Like Dave Chappelle once said, you know, people in America want to wear Nike shoes. They don't want to make them.
Yeah.
So he has this nostalgic view of economy.
Did you see that bit from is it Michael Wolff's book? And it's Mark Cohn talking to Trump and he's going, why do you think this about tariffs and about bringing back factories and all this? You know that Americans don't want to work in factories, right? So why do you think they do? They want to work in offices that are clean and everything. And Trump goes, I don't know. I've just always thought this for 30 years. And yeah. Cohen says to him, yeah, I thought for 20 years I was going to play in Major League Baseball, but I had to let that one go. But you just thought there's actually, he doesn't think beyond yeah. one step of it. It's extraordinary.
But actually, for anybody, I highly recommend watching the movie American Factory, the documentary,
okay,
which is about a former car factory taken over by the Chinese. It's back, I think, 2008 or 9. And it just shows the culture clash. And this culture clash of China,
yeah,
the nostalgia American culture, is the defining clash for me. So if you listen to the Chinese leaders, like Xi Jinping talks about the young people should eat bitterness. It's an age-old aphorism in Chinese culture, which means put up with things in the short-term pain for long-term gain. Xi Jinping himself is a lifetime political leader. Now compare that to Trump, right? He's a man who not only doesn't eat bitterness, he spreads bitterness. He is going to elections in 2 years' time. He's got a 4 years unless he has a constitutional coup. So right now, while China might be more exposed to tariffs, it's got the balance of momentum behind it because it has mastered not just the big idea, AI, but how to put that big idea into practice, the supply chains, the infrastructures.
Yeah.
I'm struck by this image of the dark factory in China, which is a factory so automated that you don't need lights because there's no humans left anymore. So America has all the big ideas, but as an entrepreneur, I found out big ideas aren't worth anything if you don't execute them properly over the long term. And that is the end. That is why the end of the American century, let's put it that way, is all about this idea of China having that long-term perspective, keeping the operationalizing the big idea front and center and avoiding your short-term drama. Whereas now America is kind of self-destructing by letting itself
become. So China are getting ahead in AI, which presumably is the next industrial revolution. And as we all know, every industrial revolution creates new winners and new losers and reorients the whole world.
Yeah, also because the United States...
And like EVs, China is... I'm sure they've gone completely ahead of everybody else. Like, how does Tesla even compete with this?
Well, we could have had Donald Trump saying to his buddies in Silicon Valley, you have everything you need. I will give it to you. You can go get infrastructure investment. We'll supply you with energy from renewable sources. We'll back you to the hilt with the money that we can expend on your ideas. And that will be a cascading wave of innovation. Instead, he's cut back the research budgets that have supported the development of science in the United States. So half of all the AI companies that are making it big in America have an immigrant co-founder. The vast majority of students working on AI research in the US are from abroad. 277,000 Chinese students in America for one reason, to learn about the technology and in most cases bring it home, but many stay.
Bring it home and do it better?
They do, but now what's happening is they're thinking to themselves, why am I here? Why don't I just go back? And we've got this amazing situation now where a French university this week is offering basically sanctuary for American scientists, many of whom are publicly declaring they're going to leave. So when you have the scientific research that's publicly funded, remember, that has supported Silicon Valley, they don't talk about it very much, but it's public money being drawn back. That itself, I think, is so much a bigger story than much of the political drama in why American decline could escalate quickly. Just as the right policy creates cascading innovation, but at a time when history is moving so fast, it takes a small self-destructive act like withdrawing Science Foundation funding to accelerate a major decline. And I think
so you
that's
only
possible.
Need one air pocket, which people are saying there is an air pocket in the American economy at the moment, no money being invested, no R&D being done and everything. Even if that rights itself in 6 months' time, you're saying things are moving so fast now that could be too late.
Yeah. As an entrepreneur, what's beaten into you from the very beginning is your big idea does matter. If you don't execute it properly, you don't have the operationalizing of it, you don't have the discipline to go and find out who your customers are. And right now, what I see is a classic innovator's dilemma. The United States had all the great ideas, the ChatGPTs of the world. The Chinese don't need to replicate that. They have open source technology. They're just much better at finding the customer for it and much better at the long-term kind of investment in the public research. So that's really where I think the accelerant is for China And that is the, as you say, the air pocket that could be really destructive for the United States.
Okay. And look, there are people texting in saying President Trump is cleaning up America. It's mostly criminals who are being deported. President Trump will be able to alleviate price increases because of all the income from the tariffs. And that is the story he's telling at the moment. The US working class was betrayed by the American investor class, which, yes, Mark was talking about that earlier. They're right to feel betrayed that US capital went abroad for cheaper labor and bigger profits. And look, yeah, I don't think that we're being very partisan or political here. We're talking in a fairly calm way about the facts of what is happening.
But there's a good point there, you know.
Yeah.
That is, I mean, you know, he is the wrong answer to the right questions in so many ways. The right questions being exactly has been expressed there. The economic injustice in American society has been the unresolved definitional problem of the United States. And the Democrats didn't do it.
They didn't listen.
They didn't listen.
Tell me this. This has been threatened for a long time now. And I remember, like, even in the, was in the 90s, everyone has been told, oh, you to teach your kids Mandarin because this is the future. Are we actually closer now, though, to that mythical, the Chinese century coming, where the world, the West, reorients itself around China? Like, the bizarre notion that China, for all the issues we had with, up to now with trading with them, and there would be a lot of criticism for politicians, etc., going on trade missions there because did they bring up human rights and all this? Is China now looking like an actually more reliable partner for Europe than America?
I think long-term economics, yes. And I think Ireland particularly is going to have this like massively schizophrenic industrial policy for the next few years, right? We will still have to pay attention to the paradigm of Boston, Berlin. But at the same time, quietly and with real intensity, we have to be looking to, you know, Berlin and Beijing. We have to be paying attention to what's going on in Shenzhen as much as Silicon Valley. And it's not about, you know, taking just a quick shift in our policy and shifting towards some sort of cooperation with Chinese manufacturing. I think there's a real role for us to get behind European leadership on this to make sure that security concerns about trading with Chinese companies, human rights concerns about the Chinese government are handled by the Europeans. But this country has to be thinking from their example, which is this. You don't need to build the next ChatGPT. You build the application on top of it in areas that you're really good at already. So in Ireland, we're very good at medical research because we've had the pharma companies for years.
Okay.
We're really good on food, where we have a real competitive advantage. Now, these are two areas that are being impacted dramatically by artificial intelligence. Medical research is being accelerated. They're talking about this compressed 21st century. So we have the capacity with small research teams and open source technology to really move ahead. And that's where we should be looking toward China, potentially, as being part of our sphere now. And on food.
So explain to me how that might work. Okay, the food industry, largely indigenous and everything. I presume a lot of those clusters of skills around things like pharma and all that, and you know, they are whole clusters. The factories are there, the local techs or universities have tailored courses to train people in for them, and that is classically Michael Porter's notion of competitive advantage, is you having those clusters, and it means that there are barriers to entry. Someone else can't do that overnight. So we have those. Are we currently working? They're currently working for the Americans. We need to get them working for us, correct?
Yeah, and follow the Chinese path, which was to import that knowledge for long enough, and then essentially through their own reforms and their market reforms and their free market system in terms of its ability to deliver to consumers is far superior to the American free market system. I mean, of course, you can't express dissent on your mobile phone, but you can order any shape, any size of any product you want and get it tomorrow. So they're really good at taking that foreign knowledge that came in, building things in their country, and then essentially understanding how it all worked and then exporting that knowledge. Now, we're in a similar position right here. Like in food, for example, I've been working a little bit with companies that are, you know, creating sustainable foodstuffs and monitoring cattle through the application of artificial intelligence. And everywhere along the line, AI can play a role, for example, in packaging, delivery, marketing. And so for Ireland to be able to say, we're kind of an application layer, we don't have to reinvent the AI wheel, we just focus on areas we're already good at. And to that extent, I think we learn from the Chinese, whether or not they become a big market. I mean, there's debates now that they will have to import more goods. Taking the model of domestic innovation and how you can accelerate that in an age of accelerating technologies. That's what we pay attention to. There's a lie about Silicon Valley, right, that it had the secret code. And a lot of Silicon Valley VC venture capitalists like to tell you that. Its secret ingredient was public research. So if the government was very focused on this domestic innovation, they would be finding ways to fund public research, potentially attracting some of that talent from the US, but investing public money in allowing us to make those big leaps, and also then making it easier for entrepreneurs, for private capital sources to fund the big idea. But it's that combination, and it's more looking at the United States and saying, well, that myth is not necessarily going to serve us, but the kind of importation of knowledge and then exporting of it, I think from the Chinese perspective, we could look at that and learn a lot.
That is, that's extraordinary, yeah, yeah. So that's the direction our industrial policy needs to be going in now.
Yeah, and I don't think it has to be big and loud. I mean, it's you know, like, it speaks softly and carry a big plan, right?
Okay.
We're not going to turn around to the Americans and say, we're going to, like, take in all your scientists and move them back into, you know, whatever universities in Dublin. It has to be slow and it has to be quite stealthy. But I think in the end of the day, that focus on domestic innovation in industries, we already have a competitive
advantage. So we have the fertile soil there.
We do. And the combination of public research, of scientific research, and the private entrepreneur. And remember, we have tens of thousands of people that have worked for big technology platforms in this country. We have huge number of people who have come into this country to work for those companies. Like when I was leaving Twitter, there was people laid off in the times that I left Twitter. There were three companies, successful companies still alive today, that were founded from that exodus of people from that big tech company. So the idea that we don't have the skill sets and we have to go elsewhere is also a myth. And I think that's one of the things we should realize about our strength in this moment as much as our challenges.
So out of this crisis, there is opportunity. Mark Little, terrific as always. I've been ingesting so much stuff about all this all week. And that's the first fresh thing I've heard, really. Thanks, Mark.
Thanks, Brendan.